allow me to introduce you to Campbell Wallace.
Good afternoon, Ian. I'm very pleased to be here.
Do you feel parental influence were foundation blocks to your inner strength?
I do, Ian. I think the family life that I was brought up in, whereby everything revolved around Mum and Dad would sit and talk about things, make a decision, and that was it. And my father was a very, very positive man, and my mother was the best mum you could have. Like, she was the housekeeper, she ran the house. And I think a lot of my health today is due to the fact that she looked after us. We lived out in the country. A lot of our vegetables and that came from the garden itself. We lived next door to a farm with fresh milk. So, I would say it is.
During the early formative years of your life, did your parents allow you very much freedom?
I had quite a bit of freedom because, as I said before, we lived out in the country, like, so I could go out the house in the morning and my mum never needed to worry about cars running me over or that. Like, we lived next door to a farm. I spent my childhood on the farm, running on the farm. I had freedom. I had a river across from us. We fished in the river. But the freedom was earned. If we misbehaved, like, then we were grounded. Any other good parents would do. But I think the fact of being in the country prepared me a lot for life later on.
To recap, there are three factors that I find my mind being centred on. One, strength, interaction and sharing. Two, discipline. You weren't allowed to get away with too much. And three, because you had that basis of thoughts, sharing and discipline, that allowed you, your parents to trust you enough to give you freedom.
I think that's very accurate, Ian. I think that made me the hardy person that I needed in later life. I think all the interaction and the discipline, but having said that, when my dad said no, we knew not to argue with that, and it was a waste of time trying to get Mum to go around him, like, because that just made it worse. That when he said no, it was no, not negotiable. And I think a lot of that is I carry with me myself. When I make that decision, I stick by it and I go for it. And it stood me well. Those early days play a very, very big part in what comes out in latter life, definitely.
I would like you to consider, hypothetically, that you were sitting next to somebody who had just been diagnosed with a very difficult disease. Let's say that this person has been diagnosed with leukemia. What would be the first thing that you would say?
Personally, the first thing that I would say to them is, don't believe everything that you read on the internet. Listen to what the professionals tell you. These are people that have dedicated their lives to helping people like you. These are the people that you're trusting your lives to. The professionals that have spent years dedicating themselves to that job, trained for years for it.
I don't want to go too far with the details that are in your book because I want to encourage people to listen to this interview and then get onto Kindle and click that and buy that book and read it. I'd like to come back to this hypothetical person. Would you invite them to have a firm understanding of their illness?
If this is life-threatening, then you need to approach it with a very, very positive attitude to it. By all means, you can find out as much as you can about it. But again, don't read too much into the internet stuff. I keep saying it. Speak to the professionals. Speak to the people that deal with us every day. And don't be frightened to ask them, can I write this down? Can I write this down, like? Because you can, at times, you get the white coat syndrome when you go to hospitals and that, and you take it in at the time, and 10 minutes later, you've forgotten what was actually said, or you've misinterpreted what was said. They will not object in the slightest to you writing down what is being said. If they give you literature from the hospital with regards to what is going to happen to you, then take it and read it, because you've got no surprises then. And in some cases, don't be worried if it doesn't actually go the exact way that it was written down, because we're all different. We're all different. You might not need something that has been covered by them, so therefore you won't get it. But don't worry, because you've no idea, because they know what they're doing. Put your life in their hands, like, and keep that mental positive attitude with you. If your family's round about you, and you're lucky enough to have a family like what I had round about me, then these people, involve them in it as well, because they don't want to be shut out. They need to be there, and they need to know as much as you know, if not more, to be prepared to catch you when you fall. And don't get me wrong, some days you will fall. That little, you know, Mr. Negative pops in, and again, that positive attitude can get rid of them. You need to move them on and keep that positive attitude going.
A day occurs, you know you're ill, shortness of breath, all of a sudden you realise you can't keep up with you, with Carol, your wife and family when you're walking. You go to a doctor, doctor makes a diagnosis, things start to get worse, the journey becomes more difficult, it becomes a situation where you just cannot do the things that you used to do, and you're then told, literally, that your life is not a case of if, it's a case of when you're going to die. What's the impact of that within your mind?
It blows it apart to begin with, to be honest with you. Like, as far as I was concerned, like, it suddenly began, whoa, this is serious now, Campbell. We need to stop and really look at this. We need to think ahead. If I'm not here, then, you know, I need to plan for to look after Carol, for to look after the kids and what have you like. And to a certain extent, you get a certain amount of self-gratification, if you like, out of it. Like, you know you've put your house in order and you can then face whatever is coming to you. But the important thing is, be honest with yourself. Now, you can paint it up as pretty as you like, but at the end of the day, you know, the final sleep is just round the corner and you don't know when it's coming. And again, your family don't know when it's coming, like, so you tend to forget about the impact that it has on the family. Like, they're living with it as much as you. Your wife has gone from being your wife to being your carer without knowing about it. She's just automatically done it. But the impact of it, I think everybody will approach it differently. I can only go by how I approached it, and that was to still keep that positive. I'll make it. As long as I get the chance. I just need the chance to make it. If I don't get the chance, then it's not my turn. But it's very sort of, being a person that was always on the go, it hurt me not to be able to do what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, lifting things and stuff like that. Suddenly, you know, my life was cut in half. I just couldn't do the things. I couldn't walk. Fortunately, I could still drive my car. And that, had they taken that away from me, like, that might have put a big hole in my positive attitude to it, by my outlook. That was one of the things that definitely kept me going, as well as the support from my family.
Is there anything that you could say, or any thought within your mind, that would just help somebody, just a touch, just a little seed of thought, that would help them just in those initial moments of something which must be abject fear and real misunderstanding of their life?
That's a difficult question, I think, Ian. Like, you can rattle off tens of different bits and pieces, but I think in minds, for having been literally at death's door, it was what sort of kept me going was the fact I've got too much that I still want to do in this world. I'm not ready to go out of here yet. Planning things in my head of what I was going to do once I had my transplant and once I had recovered from it, like, those things, I could go on holiday with my wife. The kids have grown up and left home now, like, so there's only really Carol and I. We could just go away for a week because we wanted to go. Suddenly, you know, your perspective of life changes in the fact that you don't know whether you're going to be here tomorrow, and tomorrow's not guaranteed for any of us. More so when you've got that hanging over you, that cloud hanging over you that says, you might not be here tomorrow, mate.
Do you have a fear of death?
I think, if I'm being perfectly honest, there is. It's not so much a fear; it's more a disappointment of what I'm leaving behind. I don't really fear where I'm going. Like, I've got my own opinions to it and whatever. Like, it must be so good wherever else we go after this, because nobody's ever come back and complained about it. So, I don't fear death as such. Like, I quite look forward to this really nice place that I'm going to go to eventually. But that's my outlook on it, Ian. Like, but I don't fault anybody for fearing death, like, because it's not something that you can go through and come back and say, look, don't worry about it, it's okay. everybody's got their own opinion as to where we go and what happened to us. You know, whether we become worm feeding in the ground or, you know, we get burnt and we're ashes scattered here, there, or wherever. Like, you know, the end of that human body. And then is it just the human body? Is it the spirit? Is it the soul of the person? You suddenly open up a whole new encyclopedia of where we're going, what we're doing. Back to the question, I did not fear death. Like, I had a fantastic life. I've met some fantastic people. I've done a lot of things. That, for example, my dad, my motorsport, my motor racing and what have you, my dad was always into motor racing. He loved watching it. He used to go to Charter Hall and places like that when he was a young man. And he could never afford to do it because he was the only wage coming in, and he brought up three kids, and that was his importance in life. But when I started it, he supported me 110%. He was my service crew. Like, he had his van, he had the petrol in the back of the van for me in the middle of nowhere at 3 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, freezing. He would be there with a smile on his face saying, "Good lad, you're still going, get on, see you the next service." So things like that you remember as the good things. Remember these things and you'll have no fear of death.
You need to read the book to understand the journey, but to give a little bit of an insight to the listener, you've been diagnosed with your illness, you're literally told it's terminal, there is one thread of hope, and its name is transplant. It's a major thing. Is it fair to say that a transplant operation is as big a surgical procedure as anything that somebody can go through?
Very much so. In my case, the double lung transplant, like, the two lungs are two of the biggest organs in your body that can be transplanted. Like, one transplant, you can live with one lung. A lot of cystic fibrosis people survive on one lung. But to have two done, like, it was 12 and a half hours in theatre, 8.5 hours on bypass, two surgical teams to do it, one to open me up, take the old ones out, one to put the new ones in, and sew me back up again. Like, but the dedication of these people and the work that they put into to producing that and to come out the other side of it, like, is amazing. I don't think that there is a bigger operation than the likes of that. It's certainly one of the most intricate ones. There's heart transplants, there's a double lung transplant with the heart as well. It's actually an easier operation to do because they don't have to disconnect your heart and then reconnect your heart. They just replace the heart with the new lung as well, all in one sort of style. So, no, it's a massive, massive operation, like, and it's I totally underestimated the recovery from it, and the amount that it drains from you. Like, you're flat on your back for, you know, a week or so after it, tubes coming out everywhere. It's very draining, and I now understand what they meant by post-op recovery, where they were concerned by my weight. They felt that I wouldn't have enough meat on me, as they put it, to survive it. And now I understand it. But massive operation, I doubt very much whether there's a much bigger one that you could have. It's when it is a success, it's a fantastic success. And don't get me wrong, there can be a lot of complications added, like, and some people don't make it. The last figures that I saw for double lung transplant, it's a 40% success rate of coming off the operating table, let alone surviving, where I'm now 4 years. I've got a lovely friend, Natalie, who survived 5 years. She just had her fifth birthday last week. And, you know, we're the exception rather than the rule, but I've always been the exception rather than the rule, and I don't intend changing it now.
The reason I asked the question is because there is an incredible amount of lessons to be learned for anybody who undergoes surgery from the monumental surgery that you had. Yeah, I remember I spoke to you at Gorton Monastery, and I was waiting to have what in effect is minor surgery, but it was quite intricate, and it was 4 hours to do it. But I'd actually listened to what you had to say, and I thought, well... And it wasn't a case of, well, if Cam can do it, I can't. I listened to the logic of what you told me, and the logic of what you told me was so effective that it helped me immensely during those 2 or 3 days I was in hospital. So what I am saying is this: anybody who's listening to this podcast, and anybody who takes the time to read your book, it doesn't make any difference if they're going to have a wisdom tooth out, any form of surgery whatsoever. If you feel that you're uncomfortable about it, you have doubts or you're worried, the chapter specifically about your procedure is bound to help them. I do believe that's true. Can you just give me a slight insight to how you tell somebody who is going to deal with procedure? Just tell them how to, would you, can you guide them and allow them just a little bit of insight of how to prepare themselves?
Well, strange to say, I've met a couple of people, basically, when we've been on holiday, like, and by pure chance. The last time I was on holiday, I met a couple, like, and I was actually reading my book just to refresh myself for bits and pieces on it, and they saw the book, asked what it was about, and said, "Don't believe this. This lad here, the woman's husband, was waiting to be assessed for a transplant." And I thought, you know what, the world works in mysterious ways at times, like, and this is the second time it had happened. But this lad in particular, like, his wife came and spoke to me, took me aside and spoke to me and said, "Campbell, will you please have a word with him, like, and explain to him, like, because he's absolutely terrified. This is, and I feel the fear is causing him more harm than the fact that the carrot, he may well survive this. Would you have a word with him and just tell him what you came through?" So all I could say to the lad was, "Look, listen to the professionals. When they say don't do this, don't do it. When they say take these tablets, take the tablets. They're not telling you to do it so they get an extra 20 quid for the pharmaceutical companies. They're telling you to do it because it's going to add an extra 20 days onto your life. Don't treat them like weatherman. The weatherman says it's going to be sunny tomorrow. You can guarantee it's not going to be sunny, but, you know, these people know what they're doing." So I said to him, try and keep life as normal as you can. Don't think on the black side to it. Don't think, "Oh, I've only got X amount of weeks to go, X amount of months to go, and I'm going to pop my clogs. Like, you know, what's my wife going to do?" Don't think like that. If you think like that, that's what will happen. Because you need that outlook whereby you've got something to look forward to rather than something to look back on. Like, if you're always going forward, you've got half a chance. And again, the hospital, they'll look after you like unbelievable. It's a fantastic system that we do have. It gets a lot of knocks, but I certainly can't knock it. A part of the book where it says, if you walk into a hospital, you just look at the number of people that are walking out of that hospital as you walk in. Those are people that walked in there with a question in their head, an illness, something wrong with them. Like, they're now walking back out. They've been told, "Yep, we can do this for you. Yep, we can do that for you. Carry on with your life, like, and I'll see you next week." Now, you can't buy that. That's life, and that's a life that, you know, this world has created for us. And particularly in the UK, I think we've got the best health system in the world. I don't think there's anybody can beat our national health. I've said before, it gets a lot of stick, like, but I've got nothing but praise for it. And you just need to keep that positive attitude to it, like, and don't worry about the black side. Like, don't let the black side in. Think on the good side. Yeah, you're going to be cut in half. Yeah, you're going to be opened up and all the rest of it, like, but you're going to come out of that and you're going to be able to walk up that hill. You're going to be able to go out and dance with your wife again and whatever you like and have two or three pints. That cost of malt whiskey is still going to be going up, like, but you'll live. So get on with it, like. PM, yeah, positive mental attitude. You can't beat it, mate. That's what I would say to them. That's what I would say to them.
You like PMA, don't you? Positive mental attitude, very powerful. Definitely. Just something springs to mind. How would you tell somebody who had a fear of injections, syringes, needles, intravenous drips, etc., how would you guide them to overwhelm that one, Cam?
I think the answer that springs to mind straight away is, do you want to live? It's dead simple. For this little prick in your arm or this little needle going in, like, that is going to keep you alive. You've got two choices. You either accept that or you die. It's as simple as that. And I think you will find when you're actually faced with that decision, suddenly that little needle in your arm no longer becomes an issue. It's look to the positives. Yeah, well, if that's what I need to do it, so be it. You just need to get over it. Remove Mr. Fear, get Mr. Positive back in there, like, and say, yep, it's some small price to pay. These people have spent hours and thousands of pounds on me, and I'm complaining about a needle gun in my arm. I don't think I'm being fair.
2 weeks after the surgery, major transformations to your body, pipes and plumbing being pulled out daily. What's going through your mind, Cam?
I understand the question, but a little point I'd like to make just before that, like, when I first came round after the procedure and that, like, a couple of days, I was probably about 3 days after it, the physio-terrorist, as I called them, came in and spoke to me and asked me how I was feeling, like, and, well, I couldn't speak, I had tubes down my throat and everything, so I thumbs up to her, like, and she said, can you breathe? And I suddenly realised, yes, I can. I can breathe. Even though there was tubes and what have you, like, I could actually breathe. And it was, my body just felt not as tired. I know that sounds strange, but it really felt not as tired, and it was not such an effort to breathe. I'm now looking to, I went off the ICU ward and I went on to the recovery ward. But I've got to comply with certain procedures before they'll let me do that. And it's getting close, like, I need to be, I've no drain tubes, no catheter, no cannulas or anything in me to be able to go into the ward, because it's a free walking ward as such. So I'm waiting on these coming out, like, and every day there was something else happening. Another tube would be taken out, like, to be honest, a couple of the drain tubes coming out caused me more pain than the actual operation did, like, because I think I was well doped up. But that was another move, another tube out. They'd given me, removed the tube to the ventilator. I was totally self-supportive by the end of the 2 weeks. And I'm now, my progress was being governed by I want on that recovery ward and I will do everything. But I had to watch I didn't do too much. And eventually, literally to the day that they said it, like, all my tubes had gone and I was released onto, in my opinion, was onto the recovery ward. But going through all that, like, you needed a goal. You needed a goal for every day. Right, I want this tube out going today. Like, right, these x-rays are going to be fine. Like, you know, this is going to, I need off the pureed food. I can get onto some thicker stuff now. Like, you needed a target to aim at every day.
What's your feeling about your future? How do you feel about your future and your future health and your future well-being?
I think as far as looking to how much longer I've got or whatever you like, I've got as much as I always had, because it really, it's no different now to what it was. Well, it's different now to what it was 4 years ago, but it's no different now to what it was 10 years ago. Life is life, and I'll just keep going until it comes to the end. If you start putting time restrictions on it and whatever you like, you know, you're asking for trouble, because the mind and the body will go, oh, only got 2 weeks to go, oh, only a week to go. Do you know what? Come next Wednesday, I'm not going to be here. And there are some people in this world, believe you me, next Wednesday they won't be here, because the mind is such a strong thing. So I'm afraid, as far as I'm concerned, I've had my second chance at it, and I am going to make the most of it. Like, and like you said in the approach to that, I never think about tomorrow. I'm way, way in front of tomorrow. Like, tomorrow will come anyway. It doesn't matter what I think about it. It'll be there, and I'll be there to do whatever it throws up at me. But no, you're right. My wife and I are in a situation now whereby, you know, if we want to go on holiday, we can go on holiday for a week, like, and believe you me, we will just do it, because I've had the second chance to do it, and I'm not going to spoil it. I'm not going to waste it. I won't abuse it. When I go on holiday, like you said about the medication and whatever you like, my doctors have made sure that, and they've checked my policies, because they wouldn't have let me go unless they had actually checked my policy to make sure I was covered for it. I could get, not only could I get back home if need be, but Carol could come with me. And my medication, if I'm away out of the country for 2 weeks, I need 4 weeks medication with me, like, because some of the places that we're going to, like, that medication does not exist. Or in the likes of the States, going to the States, like, which we do maybe twice a year, going there, like, if I needed to buy that medication out there, like, I'm looking to $5,000 a week for the medication that I'm on here free of charge in the NHS. So as far as that goes, you just need to behave yourself, do as you're told, look after yourself, and take each day as it comes, by all means, but have that plan ahead. Always have something further down the line. And it's back to what I said earlier. Look for the nice things. Create that system whereby you've got something to aim for. And once you've got that one, it's a bit like the bucket list. Once you've got that one, add another one onto it and keep going.
You've got a 20-year-old man standing in front of you, and he says to you, Cam, give me three pieces of advice. And if you give me those three pieces of advice, I promise that I will live by them. What are those three pieces of advice?
Live every day to the full. Live every day without regret. Treat mistakes as a learning curve. Life will always keep you right.
Tell me why it is so important for every single human being in the civilised world to consider becoming a donor.
I don't think you could ever make a more poignant or significant decision in your life. And at the end of the day, we can all have our thoughts as to where we go after we pass and the final sleep is coming. We are just an entity lying on that bed. We need the fact that we can now give these things, lungs, hearts, kidneys, and loads of other things, even down to ligaments and skin and even bone can now be used in transplant. And not only transplant, half of the word's right, it transforms somebody else's life and gives life to that person. There's no doubt about it. I would not be here today if it wasn't for the generosity of my donor and my donor's family. I can never thank them enough. Thank you, it's a powerful word, like, and sometimes it's used very flippantly, as in thank you very much and you move on, like. But thank you is the only thing that I can say to my donor's family, like, and I've said it in a letter to them. And it's just not enough, but there's nothing else you can do about it. Like, all that you have done is you have helped that person get what was one of their last requests in life. So donors are fantastic people. Like, they're, in my eyes, they're heroes. They can be angels, whatever you want to call them. Like, you know, next to my wife and family, they're the most important person in my life has been my donor. I would not be here today without them. And I don't think there isn't really words to describe it. But I also think you need to be in my situation whereby you have got somebody else's body parts inside you making you function to appreciate what that person did. Due to the nature of the procedure, the surgeons need to come to you and ask so that they can never be accused of switching off your machine because you had a pair of lungs that they knew somebody would need. They need to come to the family, and it's done very, very sensitively, and say, you know, look, can we have your permission to carry out what his wish was? And it's an extremely difficult time because 90% are sudden deaths, being a car accident, or they've fell and they've hit their head in the pavement and they've passed. And your life's turned upside down, and you've got this person coming along saying, oh, can we just have Jimmy's lungs or Mary's heart or whatever? You've got somebody, you know, your head's mush, you don't know what you're saying. So if you prepared for it, like, and they come and they ask you and say, yeah, I know that's what Campbell wanted, or I know that's what Carol wanted, or whatever, like, by all means, go ahead. Again, due to things like better safety in cars, better health and safety at work, there's less people on the donor register now, percentage-wise, than there was 10 years ago. And that sometimes it may be down to religious aspects or different cultures with different views on it. Like, but it also means there's still lots and lots of people out there that aren't on the register. And for a simple click on a computer, that could be a massive life-changing decision that's made. And life-changing for seven people is the sort of norm for an average one. Be it one person get one kidney, one person get another kidney. One person one lung, one person another lung, a heart. You know, it's amazing just the amount of things they can. Corneas, skin, ligaments. There's lots of things that can change people's life. And believe you me, they are life-changing. I have seen lots of them for various different things. And these donors change people's lives. So I'm going back to it. Thank you. Thank you is all I can ever say to them. Like, you know, because there's nothing else I can say. But I promise you, I will look after the gift that you have given me. You gave me two lungs, but to me, you gave me life, and I will look after that for the rest of my life as best I can.
If you go on to the donor registry and you have put thought into going on to the donor registry, it is essential. The word is essential. that you speak to your family and you inform them of your intention and you inform them of your choice, you inform them of your decision to enter onto the donor registry. If they vetoed it after your death, they would be going against your wishes. And to some degree, it is worthwhile saying to them, if you go against my wishes in death, you will have that on your conscience forever. Do you think that's unkind of me to make that suggestion?
No, I don't think it is, Ian. I think the more of that suggestion is out, like, in fact, I've spoke to people and I've done talks about it where I've said, in my opinion, at least tell three different people, because the chances are possibly your next of kin is unconscious in a hospital bed beside you because you've been in a car crash or you've been knocked over walking across the street, the two of you, like, so she's obviously, or he's obviously, the next person that they would go to. But you need to extend that out a little bit, like, and I would say a minimum of three people, be it your son, your daughter, people that they're going to get in touch with. That can say, look, my dad said this or my husband said that, whatever. I would say a minimum of three people know about it, and that choice is up to you which three those people are, but three of them know, so that you do it. And the point that you made, like, that is effectively my dying wish, and if you do not stand by my dying wish, then I'm afraid you're going to have that in your conscience for the rest of your life. So yeah, no, I don't think it's aggressive or too hard to say. I think it needs to be put in as strong a words as that, and I would back anybody that said it. Like, I would stand up and say it any time.
What you're saying is it is important for a donor to make it absolutely clear to his family and friends that it is his desire to have his organs donated if he dies, and tell more than one person and make certain that each and every one of those persons knows that you've spoken to other people about it. So there's an irrevocable trail of evidence that the desire is to give the organ as a gift if you die through an accident.
That's it in a nutshell, Ian. That is exactly right.
Thanks for that interview, Cam. Absolutely fabulous. Tons and tons of information there for anybody thinking about becoming a donor. Such an important thing for everybody to consider. I think you said to me once, to become a donor is showing you're a real human being and you care about the world and you care about everything that is matter. So we'll come to a conclusion. Great interview. Thank you very much for all the information that you've given. The book Second Chance is available from your website, it's available from your shop, it's available whenever you appear at events. The Kindle book is available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year in every country of this world. All you need to do is click and spend $3 or $4 to get the most inspirational thought, particularly if you're not very well. There's nothing more that I want to cover during this interview because it's all in the book. I want this interview to be literally like bait on the end of a hook for people to listen to. There can be no harm. If you get one, and there's literally tens of different ideas and thoughts about illness, going through surgery, recovery, family. There's even things in there about money and how you should contemplate your finances during serious illness. There's so many things covered. Of course, the most important thing I consider about my lesson from it was this thing about donors.
Thank you very much, Ian. Yeah, I'm 100% behind you, mate. I know it doesn't sound much. If I get one person off of this podcast that signs up for it, like, then the podcast has been all worthwhile, because that could be seven lives that I have just saved through that, like. And I look at it as I've helped save lives, like, and I don't think I'm being selfish by that. Like, I'm using my experience to promote the donor system in this country, and I couldn't support a better system. Like, I'm living proof of it.
There is another thing, one last thing that we need to contemplate. If you are a institution, anything from Women's Institute to After Dinner Speaking, Your hour talk is absolutely fascinating, and I would like to tell anybody who's listening to this, they can contact Cam on
campbell-wallace@hotmail.com or campbellwallace.org, which will take you to the blog page.
And they can entice you for a few quid to come along and talk to them. If you decide to get Cam to come and talk to you about his journey, I can tell you that you will have the most entertaining hour you'd ever wish to listen to. And so, finally, goodbye from me, Ian Timothy, and...
It's goodbye from me, Campbell Wallace. But hopefully, not the end, you'll be hearing from me again soon. Thank you very much.